Hello and welcome to the special holiday edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Over the course of season one, we came up with a lot of great content that we couldn't quite fit into our regular episodes. So we decided to make this bonus episode for the holidays to give you something to listen to and enjoy this director's cut of content. First up is Robert Swift, also known as Swifty. He has some tips for job seekers, including whether or not you should consider accepting a counteroffer.
It seems like in most interviews that interviewers ask you, do you have any questions for me? As if you've been talking to somebody for 25 minutes and now it's your turn to tell me what your concerns are. And that's not what that section is for. That section is for you to ask questions that will provide you and them with more detail about your qualifications. I always tell people there's only two questions you ever want to ask at the end of a phone screen. And the first one is always ask about the interviewer. If they've told you extensively about their role already, you want to just ask a little bit more. How long have you been with the company? Where were you at before this? How did you hear about it? You know, those types of things really help you build rapport with the interviewer. People get to talk about themselves. And if they talk about themselves in context to the company they're working for, that actually gives you a valuable insight that is a very difficult question to craft otherwise about a company. And that actually does serve you, but it also gets them to feel like they're sharing their information and their experience. It crafts a much more positive interview experience. Mm-hmm. It has a very high ask rate to have people come inside. And the last question is the weaponized question. An expert in technical recruiting taught me this question about 5 years ago, and it's the only question I would ever use in an interview at the end of an interview. When you ask that question, it will end your interview. It is an interview-ending question. And the question is, and I can do the meta after it, is there anything from my background or from this interview that you feel will prevent us from moving to next steps? The meta is there anything you missed in my resume? Is there something you're holding on to that we haven't covered? Or is there a communication that didn't happen during this interview that maybe now would be a good time to cover? Mm-hmm. But what it does is it gives people, especially on phone screens, that thing that everybody desperately wants, which is feedback. And it's a cleverly crafted question. You know, if you ask somebody at the end of an interview, hey, can I have some feedback? They'll say, oh, you did great. Everything's fine. But if you say, is there anything missing or can we move to next steps? In sales, that's called a presumptive close.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
and it gets people to respond positively. If they can't think of anything right then they kind of have to start talking about, well, here's the next steps. And I'll be honest, I coach people to use this question a lot. And based on what they hear the person on the other side of the phone say, I can 75-25, which is better than most times, tell kind of what the company or the interviewer is thinking. And you will too. It's a great way to get feedback. It ends your interview, but it's a relief to end that interview. You know, like after 25-30 minutes of talking to somebody, when you end with that question, it really helps. You know, I don't know how many times you've had interviews or talked to people on the phone, and it's just like, well, okay, do you have any more questions? You know, like when you ask that question, there's not, do you have any more questions for me? It's, you have asked the last question.
So nowadays, you know, there's some people that are full-time, some people that are contract, some that do a little of each, some people do contract to hire. The stints that you see at companies definitely tend to be shorter. I mentioned in an earlier podcast that, you know, spending 25 years at IBM and getting a gold watch when you retire is not likely these days. You know, it might be 1 to 2 or 2 to 5 years. How do you kind of adjust your career based on this and the fact that full-time and consulting, the line's really getting blurred?
Well, I will tell you that having been in the trenches of agencies and been in the middle of spam hell, trying to reach out for companies and find them people, I cannot, and I have not been that person, but I can tell you that I've been the counselor, the bartender, the psychologist of thousands of engineers. And the people who do best are the ones who are buoyant about that 3 to 5 year experience. the ones who are buoyant and see very clearly the scope of their current project and who have confidence in their methodology and team for getting them to their next spot. The things that I tell people for the 2 to 5 year dance, as I say, it used to be 3 to 5. Now companies, if you do a 2 year hop from place to place, like if you're a 4 year person at a development group, like you're
the
a
old
senior.
Timer.
Yeah. I put somebody out of college, graduated with an art degree, but was dabbling with C#, was a senior developer in C# and front end JavaScript within 2.5 years. Hmm. And that guy's been there for 5 years. By the way, I'm going to call him later. Hey, John. That type of being buoyant about that kind of bounce are the people who have been super successful. The ones who, when you call them or you contact them, have a really good attitude about maintaining the type of buoyancy for the kind of career. So what are the best, that you know, the habits of highly effective people in the 3 to 5 year full-time or consultant dance? People who show interest in what they do outside of work. Nobody wants to crush 40, 50 hours a week and then have to go someplace and volunteer, et cetera. But go to conferences. Go to other places. Get on GitHub or do a hackathon or even just pick up side projects. Anything that you show, that you can show on a resume, that you can just talk about, that develops your skill or shows some interest in what the current state of technology is. Because, I mean, at this point, you know, people used to say, well, I did Java back in the 90s, and then in the 2000s, they changed it, and some people are in companies that don't have the bleeding edge technologies, so how do I fix that? It's been fixed. There are people out there showing a strong interest in providing people with additional training, additional opportunities to dip your toe into new frameworks. Most developers just don't want to have to do it. But the people who are most successful are just really very malleable and say, now I'm working with a newer framework. I'm doing a side project. I've learned WordPress. It's not part of my job, but you know, I've got this covered at Capacitest on it.
It's a good habit once you do, say, leave somewhere. You leave company A, you go to company B. Like you said, get everyone's contact info, connect on LinkedIn, et cetera. When you arrive at company B, after a couple of weeks, touch base with your friends at company A. And that then is the perfect time for you to get a LinkedIn endorsement.
Yes.
So for those not familiar, on LinkedIn, you can ask someone or say, hey, would you endorse me for this skill set? Would you write a quick blurb? Some people say, hey, you write it for me and I'll post it with my name and just edit it. You know, you can take the work out of it for them, but others prefer to kind of author it for you. The reason I say to do it then is, let's say you've been at a job for 2, 3, 5 years. And all of a sudden endorsements start showing up and you start editing your LinkedIn profile, recruiters are going to notice, including the ones at your company.
Yes. And when an endorsement comes in, you have complete control over what endorsements are posted and you get to read that, even if you have a free account on LinkedIn. That sort of marketing is something that I've seen a lot of more experienced engineers be resistant to, but that's your new retirement plan. You need to cultivate those types of things. So getting those endorsements, using LinkedIn that way, it's a gold. And it shows also that you're willing to cultivate those skills. I use references to get a company to reply back to me when they're kind of slow about responding after a first or second interview. So I'll like send them an email, like I did an interview with them or I went on site and they're waiting to make a decision. I always say, hey, Robert here. I was wondering where you were at with the decision. By the way, here are my references. And I send them the email addresses and phone numbers. That's, again, that presumptive close. But it's a great reason to touch base and you're not bothering them, but you're also providing them with information. And the last thing I was going to mention is always remember that you are competing with other people. And if you've sent references in, you are probably one step ahead of whoever you're competing with. While this person's so confident, they've already sent references and I can see the corresponding references on LinkedIn and apparently these people really like them.
So a lot of times when folks accept a job offer and then go to let their current employer know that they are leaving, giving their 2 weeks notice, their current employer might come up with a counter offer in order to raise their comp or title or whatever, in order to get them to stay. Would you say it's ever a good idea to do that? And do you have any stories or horror stories about this process?
We tell people not to accept counteroffers. If you Google counteroffer or do I accept a counteroffer, all the salespeople tell you never to accept a counteroffer. And I'm right here to tell you, don't accept a counteroffer. I've heard engineers reply back and say, that's just agency people saying they don't want to lose their commission. They don't want to lose their thing. No, counteroffers, all of the research done on it is that like 80% of people who accept a counteroffer will not be working for their company within a year. And you asked for the craziest thing. I once was working at a very large agency, will not use a name, where accidentally one side of the desk was trying to find someone a job and the other side of the desk, like, and I mean side, like about 35 feet away, was a senior person who was working with that company as a client. And the candidate got an offer from another company. They were getting them all set. And he went to his company to give notice, and his company gave him a counteroffer, and he accepted it. The agency guy on the left side of the desk was irate and said, you never accept a counteroffer. It's incredibly blah, 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 blah. And when he was saying, and then the guy said, well, I'm sorry. It's like, I'm comfortable where I am now. This is exactly what I wanted. And he hangs up the phone with the guy and starts loudly bitching 40 feet away. And the senior agency person on the other side of the desk, 40 feet away, is on the phone and he has his hand in the air with his finger up. And he says, okay, thanks. No, I understand. I know exactly who I'm looking for. And he hangs up the phone and says, did you just try to move somebody from a company A to someplace else? And they said, yes. The boss from company A just called me. And they said, they just gave somebody a counteroffer. We should start the process to replace them. No joke. I was sitting in the middle of those two desks.
Simultaneously.
While that guy was talking to his recruiter, telling him that he had just accepted the counteroffer, his boss was literally working to replace him. So is that hilarious or is that a tragedy? Can't tell.
Well, thank you, Swifty, for those stories and tips for job seekers. Next up, we have Jared Taylor. You may remember Jared from episode 5 of Underserved. Jared's from Florida, was up this summer to visit us, and we got a chance to sit down and record some other topics, but never had a chance to actually get them into a new episode. So these are unreleased, lost tracks from our conversation with Jared. We're going to talk about minimum cognitive load theory, why you might want to take a nap in public in order to break out of your comfort zone, mixology, specifically how to mix a good tiki cocktail, and maximizing enjoyment of your coffee addiction. Let's join Jared. Another topic that we had spitballed on was minimum viable cognitive load theory. That's a mouthful in hardware, software, and UX.
So the thinking behind that is anytime you're building any kind of code base, an app, a framework, writing your own language, doing tools, whatever it is, I like to think of if someone were coming in and learning this, how much would they have to learn and how much would they have to keep in their head while they're using it? And the less they have to think about when they use it, the better. And I think that applies to really anything you're building, anything that people have to use. You know, just cut down that cognitive load, cut down the mental model they have to build in their head. And it tends to simplify a lot of things.
I find myself liking apps more that I have a very small buffer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot going on. Like, you know,
it used to be a lot bigger, and then the internet came along and
yeah, made us all like twitchy, dopamine addicted with people with no attention span and no ability to remember.
You remember having to when you learn to program something, you get the book out on it, the manual, and then you'd have to remember everything in it so that you didn't have to spend all your time looking it up again. And now it's just like
Stack
Google
overflow,
everything. Google. Yeah.
Well, and so we had talked about on another podcast, you know, in interviews now, like a lot of times they're completely unrealistic. They're like, all right, we're going to do a code test, but no Googling and no this and no that. Like, that's not how you work.
Not at all. And I've done, I've gone in for interviews before and they'll do like whiteboarding tests where you go up and draw the architecture for something. Mm-hmm. And I'll just like put SO in for one component of it. And they'll stop me and go, what do you mean? I'm like, well, that's where I would look this up on Stack Overflow because I don't actually know how to write this yet. And it, you know, it works because if they're watching you do it, they do the same thing.
What about the kind of least number of moving parts with this minute of minimum viable?
Yeah, you should get a better name for this.
MVCLT does not exactly roll off the tongue either.
But yeah, the moving parts is a good part of it too, I guess. It's especially with code, if you're writing something, what are the effects going to be through the rest of the app? What are all the side effects of what you're doing? And the less of them, the better. And if it's, you know, if you're writing a framework or something, the less parts in it, the less layers to it, the better. You know, just make things more straightforward.
There is an elegance in simplicity.
Yes. Which is also why I recommend people learn functional programming. You know, the idea of not having side effects with anything you're doing. And even if you don't use it day to day, it makes you think about things in a different way.
No globals?
Well, yeah. the kind of mini tangent that I'll go off on sometimes with that is people do a lot of MVC stuff on the server, which never really made a lot of sense to me. If you're doing a UI or a front end thing, you have a state that you're building around, and the MVC architecture works really well there. But on a server, you generally don't. And it's more of a request response kind of thing. You know, request comes in, you do whatever you need to do and send back a response. And functional programming always seemed a much better fit for that, to me at least, because it's, you know, a request comes in, you transform data, you send a response, that's it.
Are you in the software consulting industry and sick of posting your resume just to get bombarded by recruiters? They tell you all about opportunities that aren't even in your skill set or even where you can commute to. Looking for a contract role in this market is a full-time job. Let Syrinx do that work for you. This is what Syrinx has specialized in for the last 20 years, both in the Boston market and beyond. Are you a full-time employee that is considering consulting options to have that best of both worlds compensation model? Do you want more remote flexibility? Or do you want to choose that specific tech stack you want to work with? Perhaps you want an increase in pay, but you're stuck in a compensation freeze at your current job? Or maybe you just want to be that hired gun that every company needs to ship products and scale. You can email us at apply, that's APPLY, at syrinx.com, or call us at 888-5-SYRINX. Spend your time writing code and let us handle your job search. Contact us today at syrinx.com.
You had mentioned, like, Tim Ferriss says, go take a nap in public. What's that?
So that was about getting out of your comfort zone. That's doing something that is easy and cheap and you can do just about anywhere and doesn't hurt anything. And, you know, and taking a nap out in public was a good example of it. Just go down, go to a little island in a parking lot, you know, and they put the trees and things. Just go lay down in the grass beside it for a while. You know, people will ask if you're okay a lot, but it's a weird, awkward thing to do. And it gets you out of your comfort zone. Another one was asking for discounts on things. If you go to buy coffee in the morning, ask them for 10% off. Don't give them a reason. Just ask.
Just politely, like,
yeah.
Hey, could I please have 10% off on that? Do you think you could do that?
Yeah. You know, the worst they can do is say no.
Yep.
Yeah.
My dad taught me that lesson back when he was alive and they lived in New Mexico. I went down to visit my dad and my mom, and we went to the Santa Fe sheepskin store in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and they had this really nice leather jacket that I was like, oh, that'd be great. Like, you could motorcycle in it. You could wear it on, you know, fall weather. It was expensive. Mm-hmm. I probably could have afforded it, but it was more than I wanted to spend.
Yeah.
And we saw it. We walked out of the shop. I'm like, oh man, that thing was nice. My dad's like, why don't you go in and make him an offer? Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, go in. He's like, the markup on that stuff's usually 30 to 50% of its price. Yeah. So figure out where that is, let them make a little money and make an offer and see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So
they can say no, or, you know,
it was definitely out of my comfort zone, but I went back in, you know, made them an offer, ended up getting it for maybe a little more than I had offered, but definitely less than the list price.
Yeah.
You know, I still have that jacket, actually. Gosh, 21 years later, at least 21 years later. You know, he said after I bought it, he's like, see, you don't get what you don't ask for. And that whole lesson has definitely stuck with me. And a lot of times I tend to be kind of introverted. I'm definitely, you know, if you say, all right, go do whatever you want. Like, you know, I'm probably going to pick an activity where I'm just kind of concentrating on something.
Yeah.
And I think moving yourself out of that comfort zone, the old phrase that there's no growth in the comfort zone and there's no comfort in the growth zone.
Yeah.
I would say that's accurate. Tends to be harder for a lot of developers or, you know, folks in the software industry to do if they're more used to concentrating on their little thing by themselves. But yeah, I think it's a good thing to kind of spread your wings a bit.
And to make a little callback there, if you're getting into music, always do this. If you're buying guitars, go ask for a discount because these stores, you know, they buy the product and it sits there for 8 months, which is a huge amount of time for anything to be on a, you know, retail shelf. And a lot of the time they will give you a discount just to get it out of the store. And you can save, you know, if you go in and buy a $2,000 guitar, $500 off is really nice.
Now for hobbies, I know one of yours is mixology, correct?
Tiki cocktails specifically. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give us some details for the layman who wants to pick this up quickly or understand what it is?
Well, the basic idea is, can you make a cocktail that just tastes really good? But there's a lot of science that goes into it, and there's a lot of kind of interesting processes and things. Start with good rum. That's always helpful.
What's good? Is it Puerto Rican, Cuban?
It comes from everywhere.
Okay.
It's like cigars or something. You know, people will talk about Cuban cigars, and they're not substantially better than you could get from anywhere else. It's
politely disagree.
So yeah, get good rum, because no matter what else you do, if you're trying to cover up the taste of something, it's not going to work. I've started making syrups and things at home.
What would be a good rum off the top of your head? And how much is it a bottle?
Diplomatico is a really good dark rum. It's $40 a bottle, something like that. Yeah. For about 30, there's a company called Lemon Heart that makes, an overproof rum. It's really good. You know, anytime an ingredient or a recipe calls for an overproof rum, Lemon Heart's always the one I jump to, because there aren't a whole lot of them, and a lot of them taste like medicine. Don't put anything medicinal tasting into your drinks.
Then you said you make syrups. It's beyond like simple syrup. It's not just sugar and water, or
that's the basis of a lot of them. Well, brown sugar is a good tip. Always use brown sugar, especially if you're using rum. They go together really, really well. Your simple syrup's your easiest one, and it's just sugar and water. It's 50% of each by weight. I do it in a blender. And then you can get into things like passion fruit syrup is one of my favorites. It tends to make everything. I've even put it in margaritas before, and it makes them better. And passion fruit's kind of hard to find.
Yeah, where do you get passion fruit syrup? You make your own?
Yes. Okay. I've never seen anyone sell it before.
Hashtag product idea.
Yeah, well, yeah. If you can get enough passion fruit. Because sometimes they're like $5 each, which is kind of crazy for one little piece of fruit. But you cut them in half and it looks like it's this thing full of little alien eggs or something. You know, it's all goopy and gross and kind of tart. You scoop all that stuff out, put it in a blender. And again, by weight, you'll do a third of the goopy inside of a passion fruit and a third of brown sugar and a third of water and blend it up until it's, you know, not chunky anymore, and then strain everything out. And what you're left with is a really, really good syrup. So I'll do those. I'll do torched pineapple, where you get pineapple spears and cover them in brown sugar and blowtorch them, caramelize it and chop those up, and then hand squeeze them, and you end up with a torched pineapple juice.
All right. It's 12:03 and I want a cocktail now.
And it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Now, you're also a big coffee fan. Can you tell us your favorite preparation and technique?
It's super simple. I just use an AeroPress and get fresh beans. That's about all there is to it.
Are you a dark roast guy, light roast, Kona, Arabica?
I like all of them. Doing the AeroPress, the flavored coffees don't seem to work so well. It kind of strains all the flavor out and you're just left with the coffee. But I like the taste of coffee. I can eat coffee beans.
I've been doing a lot of cold brew lately. It seems to be easier on my stomach. For folks who haven't tried it yet, normal brewed coffee, you're usually heating water to boiling or that neighborhood, running it over. Running it over the grounds and you get it, the resulting coffee. A lot of times iced coffee is just hot brewed coffee that they've cooled off.
Mm-hmm.
Cold brew instead, think of it almost like making tea, like an iced tea, if you will. You take the grounds, you put them in with water, and then hopefully have a smart way to separate the two when you're done. Here at work, we've started getting industrial quantities of cold brew. We're making it 5 gallons at a time using a food safe bucket and this almost strainer net that you can drop into it and put mm-hmm. the grounds in there and 4 gallons of, So my recipe is a 5 gallon food safe bucket, preferably with a spigot,
mm-hmm.
4 gallons of water, and then a 2.5 pound bag of dark roast coffee. We seem to like, I think it's Cafe Verona, Starbucks stuff. You can get a mm-hmm. BJ's already ground. Dump it in 4 gallons, let it steep. 12 hours seems to be the sweet spot. Anything over 16, it starts getting too bitter and strong, and even diluting it is hard. Anything under that, and it doesn't seem to really steep enough.
Okay.
And when you put the water in, you got to kind of stir around the...
Oh, you have to agitate it. That's actually a big... That, I think, is the key to why I like AeroPress coffee better than like your usual kind of drip machine is because it agitates the coffee grounds and that gets the flavor going. So I time this out actually. It's 11 seconds on my little industrial grinder. I'll put that in the AeroPress and fill it with almost boiling water and stir that around for a while and let it sit for about a minute and a half and then press it through. And one of the... Great pro tip there is if you go on Amazon for like a dollar or something, you can get a little metal filter instead of using the paper ones it came with and just rinse it off every time when you clean it.
Nice.
Yeah. Way easier.
So the similar thing with the cold brew, I noticed that when you add water to dry coffee grounds, they don't want to mix with the water really.
No.
they really actively resist it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to...
They're oily too.
Yeah. I try to drown them with water and then I actually use a ladle inside that bucket to agitate the grounds and get them really to make sure they're completely wet, covered with water.
Yep.
And that definitely gave a much better, fuller flavor than just dumping it in and hoping it would steep.
Yeah. It's part of the AeroPress thing too. When you buy it, it comes with a big plastic piece to stir with. But you're usually only doing a cup at a time. So it's kind of a quick process.
Yeah, with the amount of coffee this place goes through, we're hammering the 5 gallons.
Yeah, I'm down to about 2 cups a day.
Huh.
Yeah, it's a struggle.
yeah, you get resistant to it.
Yeah, and both in the morning now too. I used to try and do one in the afternoon, but it's easier if I just do one big shot in the morning and be done. It's also an appetite suppressant, so I'm not hungry for breakfast.
I'm with you there. All right, well, after hearing Jared, I either want a coffee or a cocktail or both. Next up, we have a short clip from Mike Bro. We talk a bit about a music style that we heard years ago that someone's actually turned into a new phenomenon released as a podcast. Have you ever heard of 2F, as in the number 2, the letter F, Two Friends Big Booty Mixes?
No, I had no idea what that meant when you sent me that. No.
All right. So these guys got together, I think when they were in high school, and started remixing songs. But the reason I'm asking you about this is, do you remember when we were in Vegas and we went to that club at Bellagio?
Do I remember? Yes.
All right. So do you remember that the DJ would play like 30 seconds of a song or a remix and like just the hook starts setting and you're like, yeah. And then he'd switch it.
Yes.
And we're like, what is this?
Yes.
These guys do the exact same thing where they take like a bunch of what we'll call like mainstream hits and take the lyrics from one and like some EDM or like a backbeat from another and mix them together in a new interesting way that you get kind of like, okay, yeah. And then 30 seconds later, it changes or less into something else. It's very catchy. And it was kind of like that same experience as the Bellagio that time. Like, you know, you're getting into it, but you're like, it's kind of disconcerting because it's changing so much. So they make these mixes 60 minutes long.
Oh.
To the point where Spotify's like, we're not releasing that as a song. They're like, screw you, we'll release it as a podcast.
Oh.
So they release these episodes of 60 minutes each as a podcast. You can get it on Spotify right now. And all the kids are into it. My daughter, Caroline, loves it. Girls on our soccer team are like, my Big Booty Mix is number 11. Mine is number 16.
Very catchy name, obviously. Also.
Yeah. So, yeah. And okay. they mix in quotes from The Office and all sorts of pop culture references. Like, oh. So it's interesting. And honestly, like if I were going to have a party and I were a kid, I would just put that playlist on and be done.
All right. So do they have sponsors?
I don't know. I mean, I imagine they're going to be paying a lot of money to get the clearances on all these songs.
Yes.
You know, like yeah. if you're going to release it, but they must be doing it. They must be profitable because they yeah. made 16 of them.
16 so far. Okay.
Yeah.
So. Wow. I wonder if it's going to be like Fortnite, like when a new one comes out, everyone's like, oh my God, Fortnite season 17.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure. Once you told me about TikTok, it's, I forget the exact pop culture term for that, but it was always in plain sight and I just never paid attention to it.
Yeah.
After you mentioned that, yeah, TikTok everywhere I see.
Hidden in plain sight.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of TikTok.
All right, this is probably the next one.
But yeah, this is probably it.
I probably saw references to Big Booty and just thought it was like some random thing.
Yeah, so it's Big Booty, but spelled like the tiny little shoe you'd give an infant. Bootie. Not booty like pirate treasure or someone's butt.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Well, folks, thank you very much for checking out our holiday edition of Underserved. And thank you for listening to us all throughout season one. We're currently recording season two and should be releasing our first episodes just after the beginning of 2020. In the meantime, have yourself a Merry Christmas, a Happy Hanukkah, a delightful Diwali, a killer Kwanzaa, or a fabulous Festivus. And we'll talk to you soon on Underserved.